don't sweat the technique.
Broadcasting live from the Mobile Veritex Community Bank Studios, located at Drift Bar in the Heights, here's Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
Happy hour until 8, karaoke at 9, LSU headquarters. Drift Bar is great. Get out here today, get out here this weekend, get out here whenever you can. 713-780-ESPN. Oso's getting a little sour that we're not reading his texts on the air. Sorry, Oso, they just haven't been good. Your standard is hadn't been great. Our standard's higher than yours, I guess. Texter, he underthrew Nico a few times after that hit. He threw one interception where he underthrew a receiver. It might have been Nico, I don't remember. But after that hit against Baltimore, he underthrew a receiver who was open and he got intercepted. So just another piece of information. Not saying that it's pertinent to what's going on now, but you'll never convince me his shoulder wasn't injury report worthy after that game. All right, anyways, Devin McCourty, Chris Sims, we're talking about the Texans. I guess this happened today or recently, whenever.
Uh-huh.
Here was Devin McCourty discussing the offensive line.
The guy that was in New England who came in.
Right.
So Dante Scarnecchia, known around the NFL as one of the
greatest O-lines ever, O-line coaches ever.
Cole Popovich came in and was under Scar. So,
right.
Like, he was supposed to take over New England. The whole COVID vaccine stuff happened.
Right.
He was let go in New England. He bounced around D2, D3 for a year, then ended up in Houston as an assistant. He now, who was with Nick Kelly, will take over. That offensive line will be built
will
in
be
a way
totally
that how
different.
Scar would build it.
Exactly.
Built off protection first,
right.
Play second.
Exactly.
Like, we're not
going to
have a play we love and say, but
we can't protect it.
They're not, you're
That's
not
what they did
that.
Last year.
You
go, oh, that was
year.
A cool play, but he's sacked for an 8-yard loss.
So there's the first kind of positive spin on the fact that there's a little bit of the method to the madness of the Texans and everything that they've already done with their offensive line, whether it be the coaches, the scheme, and or how it relates to the changes they made on the offensive line. And especially coming from a guy like McCourty who played at New England, who knows Scarnecchia and knows exactly – and Scarnecchia is high, of the highest regard on offensive line coaches. I think this is all encouraging.
So the encouragement is that they're kind of following what the Patriots did?
Yeah, and the fact that – The belief is like Scarnecchia did, that they believe that Popovich, who is the same kind of coaching style and everything else, was looking for the scheme and the players that could do the scheme, and they could coach up those players to do it the way they needed to do it to execute the plays, as opposed to, hey, Tunsil's top five left tackle in the league, so regardless of anything else, he's top five tackle, let's just let him go.
Yeah, more about scheme and cohesiveness and stuff like that.
Here was
Chris Sims discussing the Texans as a Super Bowl contender.
Yep.
Getting to is I think people are sleeping on the Texans. The Texans are a Super Bowl team. The Texans could go to the Super Bowl this year for the first time in franchise history.
Wow.
I think between what he said on defense, we both think the offensive line will get fixed. They would definitely be on the short list team for me. I know.
That was a little bit surprising.
Do you believe Chris Sims, though? Like, have you ever found him to be credible or a guy like
I mean, I know he can be a clickbait guy, but I think the key here to me is McCourty, because McCourty, especially on the first comment, but McCourty's agreeing with him even here in the fact that I think that says more about the talent scheme, and McCourty ends up going into it in the next clip where he kind of elaborates further about the fact that this process has taken a little time, but the combination of taking a Patriot guy like Caserio and combining him with a guy like D'Amico that likes that high motor, high energy type guys, that now it seems like the roster is there to kind of back up what Sim said in terms of the fact that on paper this is a team that could compete to get to a Super Bowl.
I'm a little insulted you're putting more Cretans in Chris Sims than me. I've called him a dark horse Super Bowl contender. Now, the offensive line has to be good. It has to perform at a decent level. Here is a final one from Devin McCourty discussing how this team was built.
The way he has built this team, the defense
Incredible.
Is built exactly how D'Amico Ryans is.
Yeah.
Like, his energy, his attitude, the way he played, the way he was in San Fran, that's the type of players they have. Now I think the offense is starting to be built a little bit like what you just said, what New England had. It's not going to be about a guy. It's not going to be about just get the ball to Nico Collins or run the ball. Like, it's going to be, if you do this, we'll beat you this
exactly
way. You
right.
do that, we'll
right.
beat you. Like, they're going to be able to be very multiple and doing different things. Like, mm-hmm. Nick Kelly came from New England, went with McVay last year for 2 years in the Rams. Like, that's kind of what you want as an offense, to get all of those different things and blend it together. It should be fun to see in Houston. Yeah.
And they went on to talk about how it's going to be more like New England did with Brady in the fact that they want to make sure that CJ doesn't have to run for his life for another year and that they want to make sure that he can stand there in the pocket to do what they need to do. And these guys both believe that they got the right coaches in place, which is, to me, encouraging because I had a ton of questions about, you know, especially first-time OC, about the fact that did they keep Popovich? Was that the right move? And some of the things that we're actually seeing even in OTAs, how Popovich has been very hands-on. Reports are he's very much coaching guys up already. So I thought all this was extremely encouraging for what otherwise, and from an offseason perspective, had a lot of people kind of wondering what they've actually done with the offensive line.
Yeah, I mean, I'll devil's advocate a little bit. I don't think anybody takes Chris Sims seriously. Like, he's usually mocked and ridiculed, especially for his quarterback rankings. So, like, if people are taking Chris Sims seriously about one thing but then are ridiculing him about another thing, I don't think you could do that, right? Like, either you trust his opinion or you don't. So I don't love it when people cherry-pick certain things that people say because it, like, paints their team in a positive light. Like, Chris Sims can say, Texans are great, we're going to look at that, and then on the other hand say that DeMeco Ryan's the worst coach in the NFL and then poo-poo all over Chris Sims, but you kept the other thing, like, in play. Devin McCourty, I haven't really listened enough to Devin McCourty to, like, know how much I validate, like, his thoughts on things. Was this on, like, a podcast? Or?
Yeah, it was a podcast. But from me, from my perspective, Devin McCourty, to me, and everything that I've ever seen him do, is no nonsense. He's going to tell you from a player's perspective. He's going to tell you from his experiences. So for me, that's why this caught my ear, was the fact that you're talking to a guy that comes from the New England system, that knows about these guys, that still has his ear to the ground for the NFL to understand, you know, what people think of the coaches, the line, everything that they're doing. So, yeah, I understand exactly what you're saying about Chris Sims, and that's fair because, yes, he has been a lot of clickbait and he has been ridiculed. But from a Devin McCourty perspective and the fact that both those guys have experiences with the Patriots, I thought this was encouraging because I was not feeling that encouraged so far about the offensive line in particular and some of the changes they made.
Where were you on the Texans before you heard this? Like, scale of 1 to 10, 10 being the most optimistic, 1 being the most pessimistic.
I think I was kind of like where I was a year ago, that I believed, like, that they were going to be an above average team in the AFC, but I wasn't convinced that they were going to be a team that can compete with Baltimore, with the Chiefs, And you know, and maybe the Bills.
So like a 6?
Yeah, 6.5.
So after you heard this, did it go up to a 7?
Yeah. It made me feel a little bit better about the fact that, hey, especially from an offensive line perspective, I'm seeing these journeymen being brought in. I'm seeing a guy that was top 5 tackle, you know, sent out. I'm seeing 3/5 of the offensive line change. And I'm going, okay, but who you're replacing them with, and you can't put all this on a rookie and a second-year guy and just expect from what we saw already of a guy like Fisher, hey, this is going to be fixed. Or that they picked up a guy from New England that's going to be their starting center, and I should feel good about it. But after hearing that, I'm like, okay, maybe there is method to the madness, and maybe I'm missing something here that it's going to be pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, they would pitch to you that they're going to be cohesive and collective unit and scheme and all that stuff, and that, you know, talent can be a little overrated, I guess. 713-780-ESPN. Let's go back out to the HRMP listener line. Phil from the Woodlands. What's up, Phil from the Woodlands?
Hey, guys, I'll stick to one topic this time. Just going on the offensive line, I still go back to thinking that this is more of a play to reduce the quantity of obvious pass rush situations for the defense. So if we put ourselves in fewer opportunities where there's an obvious situation where that defense is coming after us and overwhelming us, we're more in like a 3rd and 5, 3rd and 4, where we can be a little more unpredictable. And that would mean fewer penalties, better communication between the offensive line, fewer mistakes, maybe a little better run blocking to get into those better down and distance. And maybe you're not as good quality-wise at pass blocking, but you've cut out a good 20-30% of those really obvious pass rush situations where you're really pinning your ears back expecting that rush to come get you and just getting overwhelmed. That's really where they seem to struggle. And a lot of times it's on those Laremy Tunsil penalties that we all talk about where we end up in those 3rd and 15s or 12s when we actually had manageable down and distance before that. And then you see Stroud get killed on a sack and then they're punting instead of kicking a field goal. So maybe it's just my bias, but I feel like that happened way too many times than it should have. But I'll hang up and listen again. Quality down, but maybe so also the quantity of opportunities to get destroyed on the offensive line, too. Thanks,
appreciate
guys.
The call, Philip. Look, I think my first response to that is going to be you still have to have effective plays that gain yardage on first and second down. You're still going to have to have an offensive line that's going to actually be able to do that, too. So I don't think that the objective was, you know, or it solved that simply, or that you can just say we're going to stay out of third and 11, third and 12s. But consistency means that this line is capable of continuity so that you can run the plays on first and second, which are the – I get the penalties are part of it too, but for the most part, you're just trying to stay out of the long situations by being effective on first and second down and not be predictable or keep running plays that don't work like we saw a year ago.
Yeah, they were penalized a lot, which you wonder if they're undisciplined, which puts you in, you know, down and distance situations you didn't love. And then on top of that, I thought that Slowick kind of fell in love with the explosive play, which, like, you have to do that at times. He would always point to how explosive they were. They're like top five in the NFL and explosive. Cool. Like, go score points. So there is, like, obviously great, more explosive plays is great. But there's also a cost of doing business. Like, if you're chasing explosive plays of a higher degree of failing than, like, a normal, you know, conservative play or whatever you want to call it. So Slowick kind of pot committing himself into explosives, I think put the Texans in bad situations from a down and distance perspective that led to them not sustaining drives, not scoring points. Yes, they had great explosives whenever you stack them up relative to the NFL, but I don't think that was conducive to having an offense that controlled time of possession, that sustained long drives, that kept the defense off field. And I think that eventually annoyed D'Amico Ryans.
Yeah, and I think that the other thing, too, was remember how many times during the course of the season we'd point out he feels like he's force-feeding an explosive play when they had a rhythm going, when they had the run game and or a good mix going to where the defense seemed to be on its heels. You were moving the ball. You were moving the chains. You were doing things. And then all of a sudden, at maybe the worst possible time, he decides to try to throw a reverse or a flea flicker or some kind of gadget play that actually throws a monkey wrench in the progress and the tempo that you were working with and then sets you back too. And I think you're probably right. I think at a certain point, all of those factors started to add up to D'Amico going, it's frustrating to the point where I got to do something.
Yeah, and I mean, those things, like, matter. Like, you should do those things, but you have to have a good feel for the game and don't overdo it. 713-780-ESPN. Texture, did I miss TK? TK coming up in 12 minutes at the bottom of the hour, 4:30. Todd Callis will be joining us. Ocho, who is using my text name in vain? I don't ever question why my texts aren't read. I just double down. Not Ocho. It was Oso, like the bear. O-S-O. Oso and Ocho. You can see why things are so confusing for us. You can see why they pay us the little bucks, because we have to define Ocho and Oso, and it's very tough. That's why you have to do vocal exercises before the show. 713-780-ESPN. Killer Bees live. Drift in the Heights. Happy hour until 8. Karaoke at 9. LSU headquarters. Great drinks. A bartender making them real nice. All right. 713-780-ESPN. One other thing you mentioned there was the Patriots' way of doing things. The Texans, once upon a time, were criticized for being Patriots South. Are you okay with the Texans going back to Patriots South? 713-780-3776. Killer Bees, ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5.
You're listening to the Killer Bees
on ESPN 97.5 and 92.5.
Broadcasting live from the Mobile Veritex Community Bank Studios, located at Drift Bar in the Heights.
Drift Bar, your perfect happy hour spot until 8 o'clock. 8 o'clock happy hour. Where else do you get that? Also, karaoke coming up tonight. DJ Captain Kevlar karaoke from 9 p.m. to 2 a.m. Great time. DJ Bobby Moe, Saturdays from 9 p.m. to 2 a.m. Live music's on Sunday. LSU headquarters. Best crawfish in the Heights. There are so many things to love here at Drift Bar in the Heights. Fresh pina colada is fantastic. Mango chili, paloma, two straws, one drink. Fantastic. Tropical Mai Tai. Bright Side of the Moon. Dragon Rum Punch. But Brian drinks fast.
He
drank that
he
like a fish.
That bucket?
It's like a fish.
Damn.
Yeah, yeah, no, it's gone. It's gone.
Brian's pounding the chest. No one can. I can drink anybody under the table. It's a Dragon Rum Punch bucket there.
Under this table? It's a pretty big table.
Yeah, pretty easy to get under this table as high as it's
that
up.
That ain't saying a whole lot.
No.
Mario on Twitch says DJ Bobby Moe's greater than DJ Bianime. It's messed up. I'm not familiar with DJ Bobby Moe's game, so I can't comment. Maybe DJ Bobby Moe's elite.
I would
probably is if he's employed by Drift or they bring him in.
I bet you Chewy would know. Chewy's got kind of like the bar rating system down. He gets out a lot, and he's very, very particular and critical. He's a good judge of judging.
You think Chewy's familiar with DJ Bobby Moe's game?
I think it's possible, because I think Chewy's been here before on a Friday, Saturday night.
Okay.
He was explaining to Donna, myself, and anyone else that would listen on the before the show about where he goes and when and the atmosphere and things like that.
So you brought up the McCourty-Sims thing, kind of like a Patriots South type of vibe. Do you want the Texans to be Patriots South? Because they got criticized for this early stages of Nick Caserio. Texter, I don't like the Texans being Patriots South. I would rather them be 49ers South. The Patriots South only works with TB12. So where do you stand on that? Like if they're kind of adapting a philosophy of the Patriots and kind of use some Patriots South tendencies once more.
I think as it relates to like Jack Easterby, as it relates to, you know, a lot of things that didn't work when it seemed like they were force feeding every single thing they did to be Patriots South. I understand that. But I think from this perspective, when you're talking about the fact that you're taking guys you're familiar with, but you're also taking a guy like Kaylee that's also had experience with one of the best offensive play callers in the league. I think that's huge. I think the fact that when you're talking about a guy that was mentoring under Scarnecchia, who is one of the best offensive line coaches the league may have ever seen, that I think that you can basically put positives on those and say, no, I totally get it that we were all sick and tired of Patriot South with a lot of the guys that they were swinging and missing and bringing in, trying to, you know, find some kind of a lightning in a bottle situation. But as it relates to this situation in particular, I'm fine with it because I think that you're taking some of what they've seen has been familiar with, that's worked very well, and implementing it with some players that they feel like can get the job done.
I feel like fans always overrate that whole deal. The Patriots. No, you're taking tendencies that you think work and borrow those tendencies. Like that's something that is not unique in any sport. Like if it's a copycat league in really all sports. If somebody's doing something well, you follow the tendency trying to replicate the success. I don't really get the vibes that the Texans are Patriots South these days. Like, are they borrowing a tendency from an offensive line coach that was really good and an offensive line system that worked really good with not great talent? Yeah, like, cool. That's fine. Like, I have no issues with that. Kaylee worked with Popovich in the past. I've heard great things about that offensive line coach from a variety of people as well, just listening to different things. So borrowing pieces of programs that have had success, I will never have an issue with. And nothing's going to be the exact same. And Caserio, I think, has moved off a lot of the, like, Patriot South stuff in his early days. And I think in large part because D'Amico Ryans is more of the face of the organization now than Caserio is.
Yeah, no doubt. And again, I think that's the way football has always worked and been built with coaches. There's a level of trust. There's a level of experience. You know what you know. And if you know that a certain coach coaches a certain way, or you know that a certain coach calls plays a certain way, and you have personnel and you like those kind of things. The other thing that's good here is the fact that, you know, D'Amico wasn't a Patriot guy. So D'Amico's going to be the voice of reason in the room too, that can also say, hey, as the head coach, I don't like that, as opposed to, you know, the coaches they had previously that were just going with every Patriot idea that might have been thrown on the table. I trust that between the two guys in the room that seem to have a really good working relationship, that have made really good decisions in the recent past, that they're going to make decisions that are going to make this football team better.
Yeah, I think we overblow the Patriots South 40. No, they're just trying to put together the best recipe they can to win football games. And if you copy a few things from a few places that had success, oh well. Texture, let's be real, we're only sick of Patriots South because of Bill O'Brien. Hey, you could be right there. That could be the
that was
bigger
part of
thing.
Well, maybe Easterby, more than Easterby Caserio. Was part of it, too.
He was part of it, yeah. Yeah, O'Brien, then the Easterby, and then Caserio's maybe more on the back end, and then maybe got away from it.
Yeah.
Didn't you get tired of West Coast offense copycat? I like innovation. Like, I want my offensive coordinator not to be stuck in one specific thing where he can adapt based on personnel and the way that the league is going. I think that's what Slowick got in trouble with. Like, you look back at last year, West Coast offenses around the entire NFL didn't have the success that they had in the past.
Right.
A lot of it was like high shell, cover two stuff, and they didn't have the success they used to have. So give me a sharp offensive mind that can adapt based on the looks that he's getting and based on the personnel he has. I think that those are the best OCs. I don't want an OC that is primarily one specific way and can never change, because I think eventually the league's going to catch up to you.
Creativity and innovation is what takes every team that has success to the next level. It can't be that just everybody's running the West Coast offense. It's how do you put your wrinkles into it and also maximize the personnel that you have that maybe another team that runs the West Coast offense doesn't have, so that you can be as effective as you could possibly be. That's where I think the best coaches stand out from the rest.
Yep. All right, 713-780-ESPN. Todd Callis, voice of the Astros. He'll join us when we return. Killer Bees broadcasting live from Drifting the Heights on ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5.
You're listening to the Killer Bees
on ESPN 97.5 and 92.5.
Time to get the latest about the Stros with Todd Callis. Brought to you by Houston Powder Coaters and Pipe Fitters Local 211. Here's Joel and Jeremy with Todd Callis.
Out to the HR&P guest line, TV voice of the Astros, Todd Callis, joining us. Todd, frustrating one yesterday. Thank you for joining us, by the way. Altuve ties it. You turn it over to the bullpens. Astros bullpen has been terrific. And then a rare Brian King off night.
Really rare. Like, one of those that you won't see maybe the rest of his Astros career. So, yeah, it was sad. I was doing some research today. That was the first barrel he gave up all year. He was the only pitcher that hadn't allowed a barrel, which is a combination of exit velocity and launch angle. But that Junior Caminero was the first he allowed. So, hey, one of those nights, I know it was frustrating because it was tied after six. But once Tampa Bay scored five in the seventh, it was not looking good, obviously. And then five more in the eighth. It actually ended up being an easy one to swallow. Those, to me, are the easiest ones to turn the page from. And you lose by 10. You really have no chance at the end of the day. If you lose by one because of a misplay or not getting the runner over, those are the ones that are frustrating.
Yeah, no doubt, TK. We were talking about it earlier in the fact that this team has shown a ton of fight, and unlike early in the season when they got down a run or two and you're like, eh, you know, are they done for the night? Now it seems like everything's going in the right direction, and they're constantly fighting back to where you can let a game like that go last night. Curious on the injury front, we had heard that Christian Walker was day-to-day. Good news on him, and then give us what you've heard after Yordan got to face some live pitching today.
Yeah, Christian back in there in the fourth spot. Yordan hitting the ball over the fence, hitting the ball the other way. As long as the hand is good to go tomorrow, I wouldn't be shocked if he was in there tomorrow. If Joe wants to give him another day or two and start him on the road trip, that wouldn't be a shock either. So he's really close. Instead of like days and weeks, I think we're hours and days now. So could he be in there tomorrow? Possibly. But would he be in there in the next two, three games? I think for sure.
Everybody loves to play fantasy GM. And, once Yordan does come back in the coming days, the move that would correspond that, who's going down? What are the options for Dana Brown? It seems like Salazar, DeZinzo, maybe Chaz would be on the table.
Yeah, I think it's probably Salazar just because that spot was brought up to free up Christian, or to free up Victor Caratini and Yiner Diaz to be able to DH. And now that Yordan's going to DH the majority of the time, you don't necessarily need a third catcher. I would think that's the likely move. I would be surprised if it was something else.
We were talking about it on the show for the last day or so about the fact that early on we were wondering like where the help was going to come from, where the offense was going to be generated from. Now with what you just talked about, the fact that both of your catchers are not only hitting, but, you know, Yiner seems to be figuring things out, hit a bomb last night. Caratini's been such a godsend for this team in all the different ways they've used him. But now Joe Espada's got his hands full because he's got guys that have been hitting, and he's got to try and find spots for them all. And that's going to be an interesting challenge to watch unfold.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good problem to have, right? Obviously, if you have to put Victor Caratini on your bench for a day or two, the guy has absolutely done everything he can to stay in that lineup. He's hit the ball well. He's had that huge hit to wrap up the sweep against the A's on Wednesday. So, yeah, Victor deserves to be in there, but he's also a guy that really has never played on an everyday basis in his career. So Joe can get creative and let Victor DH one day and let Victor maybe give Christian Walker a day off against a tough righty another day. And obviously he's going to catch him with Yiner Diaz. So he can get creative and still give him four starts a week, let's say on average. But the days of seeing Christian start five or six games in a row when Yordan comes back are probably over.
Todd Callis, voice of the Astros, joining us on the HR&P guest line. Our conversation presented by Pipefitters Local 211. They do it right. Framber Valdez on the bump tonight, TK. He's been really good over his last several starts. What have you seen differently in him over the last four or five starts for Framber?
Just the conviction with his pitches. And, you know, last start I think he had four walks. But he can get in and out of trouble, and he is just so confident with his curveball and his sinker. He can almost be a two-pitch pitcher and be good enough to be an all-star. But then you throw in this changeup, and he's just pitching with a lot of confidence. And I think he likes the fact that he is being counted on and leaned on to go deep into games more so now than ever because of, you know, Ryan Gusto yesterday going three and change. Lance, for the first time, went more than five. Great to see McCullers go six the other day. And then Colton Gordon's still trying to figure it out at the big league level as well. So Framber likes the fact that he is the guy that they really lean on, along with Hunter Brown, to go six or seven occasionally. But what I see is a guy that continues to pitch with confidence. He knows his curveball. He can tell people it's coming, and they're still not going to be able to hit it. So I expect him to give the Astros a bounce back right back in the win column today.
TK, we were talking about the fact that the Tucker trade looks like a trade that's worked out just swimmingly for this team, even with Wisniewski being lost for the year for the surgery. But now it looks like Cam Smith is really starting to figure some things out. He looks comfortable. He's hitting the baseball. And you look at where this team would be if they didn't have a guy like Paredes and all he's done this year. The trade's looking really good right now for Dana Brown and this team as it relates to this year, but also still for the long term.
Yeah, it's crazy to think about. If you like to trade in 2025, you're going to love it in the future just because of the years of control. So this was the year where you would assume going into the season that everyone was going to say, well, this doesn't seem to be right because Tucker's doing this, and Tucker's having a great year, and these guys aren't really up to the Tucker level. But, yeah, Isak Paredes has been phenomenal at third base. Cam Smith is absolutely figuring it out. His exit velocity has been off the chart lately. Right up there amongst the top on the team. It seems like every other game he has the hardest hit ball in the game for the Astros. It's unfortunate what happened to Hayden Wisniewski, but he's a guy you will hear from in the future as well. So, yeah, it's 2025. Looks like it's close to a wash. Then it's huge advantage to Astros just based on the control years beyond this.
Todd Callis on the HR&P guest line. Todd, you brought up Lance McCullers, and obviously his last start, so much to be encouraged about, the six innings, the 102 pitches, the 12 strikeouts, more than any Astro this season, tied his own career high. The swing and miss over his full body of work, all five starts, really impressive. I know the ERA is not there, but, I mean, five starts in 2.5 years. He's averaging nearly 13 strikeouts per nine. He has 26 strikeouts and 18 and a third. I think that the swing and miss stuff is better than anybody would have thought it would have been at this point.
Yeah, it was really, really good in his last start. I thought that was, you know, as close that we have seen to vintage Lance in a long time. So, big swing and miss, getting 12 strikeouts. I don't care what team it was. I know it was a young A's team, but it was still highly impressive. And for Lance to go out there, pitch six innings and go over 100 pitches, that was huge for him and huge for the Astros. That game will go a long way towards helping the Astros heading into the All-Star break and hopefully winning another AL West division. But, yeah, the ERA just took that hit that one day against the Reds. The rest of the time, other than that one blip, and you can't discount that game. It happened, but that was what obviously shot up his ERA, similar to what Brian King could. Brian King could go 2 months without allowing a run to just get his ERA back to where it was before last night. It's a little tougher for a leader. But same thing with Lance. That Reds game set him up for a tough ERA for a while.
TK, I know that people were starting to press the panic button and wonder about Jose Altuve. You had basically said to everybody a week ago, hey, look, you know, this is Jose Altuve. He's going to figure it out. No worries, no concerns. But I don't think anybody thought it was going to be this quick and on this kind of a heater that he's on right now at home. Five bombs on the homestand, and he looks like the old Jose Altuve again.
Yeah, you can count me in that group. I didn't know it was going to be this quick. I mean, to go four home runs over his entire season and now hit five in the first six games or seven games of the homestand is pretty remarkable. But, yeah, Jose can get as hot as anybody in baseball. When he gets hot, he usually stays hot. So hopefully this carries over for a couple of weeks. But huge signs of progress for Altuve, hitting the ball out twice in the first game of this homestand, hitting the ball twice in the first game against the A's and hitting the ball out once last night in the first game against Tampa Bay. Those are huge signs for Altuve moving forward, and It was a matter of time, but there was you can't say there wasn't any concern because you're not used to Jose going over a month and hitting under 200 like he did this year, but it's great to see him back.
Todd, great stuff as usual. Have a great call tonight.
All right, guys. Talk to you next week.
You got it. It's Todd Kallas, voice of the Astros on the Shin. Our conversations each week with Todd, presented by Pipefitters Local 211. They do it right. Blanker's ducking out. He's going to go to his daughter's graduation. So, Brian McDonald and I taking you the rest of the way here. Drift in the Heights. Happy hour until 8. Karaoke later tonight. Let's keep it with the Astros. Isak Paredes. I've seen enough. I want to extend Isak Paredes. Other guys, too. How about Pena? How about Hunter Brown? What would that cost look like? 713-780-ESPN. Killer Bees broadcasting live from Drift in the Heights on ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5.
You're back with the Killer Bees
on ESPN 97.5 and 92.5.
Broadcasting live from the Mobile Veritex Community Bank Studios, located at Drift Bar in the Heights. Here's
Drift Bar.
Joe Blank and Jeremy Branham.
Drift Bar is awesome. Donna's out here. Chewy's out here. Got everybody out here. A lot of fun. No Blankers, though. Michael's out here. I didn't catch the guy next to Michael's name. That's my bad. But he was blasting Blankers.
The guy with the blue shirt?
Yeah. Yeah. The roughneck
guy. Blasting Blankers? For
yeah.
What?
Well, Blankers left early to go to his daughter's graduation.
He's a part-timer.
And I didn't, I mean, I have no leg to stand on. But I didn't think to ask what grade she was graduating. And
yeah, I don't know which daughter this is.
Donna said it was pre-K.
Well, I know his youngest daughter's
pre-K, like, graduation's where he's going?
It might be, because I know his youngest daughter's 4, so if it's her, then that would be pre-K, yeah.
I didn't know that there was pre-K graduations. I thought it was a kindergarten thing. And
yeah,
maybe like
my daughter's 3, and she had a ceremony 2 days ago, but it wasn't called a graduation. It was just like an award ceremony.
Huh.
And every kid got like a little certificate of completion thing.
So that was that like what was
it,
that? Daycare?
No, it's Humble ISD. It's,
oh, okay.
It's an actual school.
Yeah. So
but,
she's walking the pre-K stage.
No, like I said, they didn't even do it like a graduation. It was much more low-key. It was just in the classroom of her teacher. And they literally just called each kid up and like, hey, here's your certificate of completion, and they took a picture with the teacher, and that was basically it.
Yeah. Would you miss work for that?
No, it was in the morning.
Okay, that's good.
Yeah. No, it was like 9 a.m., so I was still in.
But congratulations to Blanker's daughter graduating pre-K. She'll be off to kindergarten.
I know. They grow up so fast.
She'll be
right?
off to kindergarten. But that's good. Family is very important. Rocky from YouTube, remember y'all doubted Jose and his OPS, which is now 740 OPS of OPS plus of 108. Never doubt Tuve's. Need to worry about Myers. I probably doubted him more than anybody else because he's 35, and I know Father Time catches up to everybody.
Yeah, I think it was more you. I think Joel was more on my side.
I was the most down on him for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, I'll own that. Look, let's see where he ends up. Like this is a huge heater for Jose Altuve. Now, look,
yeah, like 5 home runs in the last week.
Like he's not going to do that the rest of the year, but I also don't think he's going to be in the dog days like he was for that period of stretch where he was. You know, the OPS was bad. I was doubting him. But I do think it's going to be difficult for him to have, like, an 800 OPS. I think it's going to be difficult for him to sustain the numbers he had last year. Now, one thing that's encouraging, I think, is that Joe Espada had some quotes through Chandler Rome and The Athletic that he's going to keep the top 3 the way it is for when Yordan comes back. So you're looking at Jose Altuve getting Yordan Alvarez protection, which I love the sound of that.
Yeah, because I think one of the things Altuve, I heard him on, I think it was one of the pregame shows, one of the things he attributed to his turnaround was his approach, and he was deciding to really more pick out like a certain pitch each at bat, and that was what he was going to attack, and he was going to wait on it. And if you're hitting behind or in front of Yordan, you're probably going to get a higher percentage of fastballs than you would receive, you know, hitting in any other spot in the lineup. So that approach from Altuve of picking out one specific pitch would seem to fit with hitting right in front of Yordan.
Yeah, I love the idea of Altuve ahead of Yordan. That's going to be fascinating. Ocho says, I don't like Blankers prioritizing his daughter over that over us. What's up with that? Sorry, Ocho. Sorry you feel that way. I don't think he cares.
And, no, I can guarantee he doesn't care.
I would prioritize my kids over you as well, Ocho. Has anyone ever won an MVP at 35 in Major League Baseball? Barry Bonds.
Anyone not enhanced won an MVP over the age of 35?
I would have to look. I mean, I don't think Jose Altuve is winning an MVP, though. Let's pump the brakes here.
Did McGuire win the MVP in 98? Or was that – no, that was Sosa. Sosa wasn't
35. Well, I mean, McGuire enhanced.
Yeah, no, I know. I'm just trying to think of guys just 35, period, regardless of enhanced or not.
Bonds won four in a row at 36, 37, 38, God, 39.
That's incredible.
It is.
I mean, enhanced, but it's still incredible.
Yeah. How about Henry Aaron? Did he ever win one, like, super late in his career?
I no idea.
How about Babe Ruth?
Same. No idea. Now, Babe didn't play at an MVP level past mid-30s, did he? I don't think he did. I mean, obviously, the conditioning of the athletes back then wasn't
as good. I mean, he was hitting 40. He was hitting 49, 46, 41, 35, 36, 37. But he fell off pretty quickly.
Yeah,
he was
so pretty, that's 46 pretty good home runs at 36. That's 6 years old. Yeah, that's okay. It's still pretty good.
But he didn't win an MVP.
Yeah,
he only won one MVP in his career. But I think crazy. It was pre-voting. I don't think they did it every year.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's
yeah.
Like,
true. I mean, I don't know. Yeah, I don't know when it started, but still, I mean, that looked like more than halfway through his less than halfway through his career when.
But they didn't have MVP voting these years. Like they were selective. I don't think there was an All-Star game until like the early 1930s too.
No, that I know is true. I don't know when the first MVP happened.
Yeah, I'd have to go look. Let's see. We'll do this in a minute. 7137. I mean, Jose Abreu might have been 40 when he won his MVP in 2020. There's a good chance.
The COVID year. Yeah, you're saying if he Miguel Tejada'd us and aged a couple years and we didn't know about it.
Yeah. Exactly. All right, 713-780-ESPN. Let's go out to the HRP listener line. Israel, you're in the Hive with the Bees. What's up, Israel?
What's going on, my guy? Hey, look at this. Now the narrative is Cam is starting. Starting? For the year. He's been doing it for the year. He's going up to 267.
Yeah.
I'm going to ask you a question after that. Last year, only one person on the Astro team batted over 300. So we can't act like they all were like 300 above. Hold on. His WAR is 1.3. Myers is coming down. Myers is 1.3. Hold on. His OBP, right, is 344. His slug is 397. You dig? So I don't understand this stuff.
397 is not a great slug, though.
He's just now starting. No, no. He's been doing it.
Well,
he's been doing
it
from the jump.
Israel. Israel. In April, March, Cam Smith hit 213 with a 679 OPS. In May, he's 324 with 807 OPS. Wouldn't you say that's improvement? It's coming on? It's getting better?
No. I'm talking about the year. The year. We got to go off the year. No. The year is OBP for the year.
Okay, yeah, he's been, and it's been improving.
OPS, hold on, for the year.
I'm with you. I hear you.
Okay,
I hear
you. Oh, this is the last thing, because y'all been bringing up the guy from Oakland. You know what I mean? The guy from Oakland, the rookie, he is on a losing team. Cam is going. Oh, he's on a winning team that's about to be first place in the division. There's not comparison. You put Cam somewhere, nobody's paying attention. It's different. It's a whole different game.
You cherry pick stats though, Israel. You're cherry picking stats.
You did it, and this morning they did it. Oh, what about the guy from Oakland? No, Cam is the guy. He's still going to be in the running. He's 267 now.
Yeah.
The last thing, Jeremy,
right.
I'm going to get off the phone. Please tell me, what you expect for 8, 7, or 9 inner? What is the numbers of batting average that you think he should have? That
would be from the bottom of the order? Good. Like 240, 250. I think that'd be fine.
He had 267 right now.
I know. Yeah, he's good.
He had 267. Right.
I'm not saying Cam Smith's bad, though. What are you talking about?
Huh?
I don't say that Cam Smith's bad, and Cam's hitting 6 tonight too, Israel.
No, you said it at the beginning. You was like he should be. Why? My thing is too. Last thing, if he wins Rookie of the Year, you know they get a new draft. They get a number one draft pick.
Right.
Okay, man. That's the goal. All right, man. Thank you, Jeremy. I fuck with you.
Appreciate you, Israel. Yeah. I mean, I think Israel's cherry-picking a few stats there. Like, he's pointing to the Cam Smith average, and he's pointing to the Cam Smith OPS, which are good for a rookie. Like, I have no – like, really good for a rookie.
He pointed to the slug, though. The slug of, what, 397. I guess it's okay for a rookie, but 397 is not a slug
I'm not worried about Cam Smith slugging over the course of his career, though.
Sure, like, I'm just saying, like, I mean, that was one of the stats that he was trying to point out as – look, and I'm not sure what – Israel's heard, because at least from this show, like, I think we've been pretty pro Cam Smith. Now, we were maybe against the idea of losing a year of service eligibility for what was a slow start in April.
He doesn't like that I
but
bring
that other than
up.
That, we've been very pro Cam Smith.
He doesn't like that I say he shouldn't have started with a big league club, which I'll never back down off of that. I don't think that the 2 to 3, and even though it's been good to really good as a rookie, it's still not going to be worth the extra year that you could have saved. Now, Dana Brown could end this entire logic if he signs Cam Smith to a 7-8-year deal.
Yeah.
That whole argument of mine becomes totally moot. It's not even worth bringing up anymore if that were to happen. But if they lose Cam Smith in, you know, this year and then five more and never lock him up, then it was the wrong call, starting with the big league club and not getting that extra year of service. Now, people might not care about that. They're not. Wait, I don't care about 6 years down the road. I understand. I totally get that. Now, where I think Israel's cherry-picking stats is whenever he compares him to Jacob Wilson. Like, he'll immediately point to the WAR and immediately point to the OPS and all the other numbers, but then he just discounts Jacob Wilson because he plays on a bad team, even though Jacob Wilson's offensive numbers across the board are better than Cam Smith's. So I just don't think that you can do that. I don't think it's fair. Now, I hope, to Israel's point, that Cam Smith passes Jacob Wilson and does win Rookie of the Year, because now it has a lot of incentive and it has a lot of great, you know, there's great bonus for your player to win Rookie of the Year, because in Cam Smith's case, it would give you an extra draft pick next year and a good one. It'd be at the end of the first round.
Yeah, no, it'd be an absolute home run for the Astros. I would look, I know you're not concerned about his long-term power.
No,
but
I'm not.
The home runs are going to have to tick way up if we're going to put him in the Rookie of the Year cut. Like an actual chance, not to be in the conversation, but to actually win it. Like, what, 3 home runs on the year now? We're one-third of the way through the season, or almost one-third of the way through the season, 3 home runs?
I mean, Jacob Wilson only has 7, though.
Yeah, but like you said, the slash lines just like are so much better. Like, I mean, he could maybe ultimately pass up Jacob Wilson in the slash lines and put himself further into the conversation. I just think if he keeps at this current home run pace, let's say he hits 12, kind of on the pace he's on now, I would have a hard time seeing him win Rookie of the Year.
Obviously it's more difficult with 12. I think it's in play, and he is in the conversation. Like, a texter's asking us, is he back in the running for Rookie of the Year?
Do we have odds?
I mean, he's probably top 5, maybe even top 3. We'll do that during the break. 713-780-ESPN. Should you be looking at locking up Cam? Should you be looking at locking up Jeremy Pena, Isak Paredes, Hunter Brown? What would the cost on that be? 713-780-3776. Killer Bees broadcasting live from Drift in the Heights on ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5.